And hello again. So, as I said, this is a recorded program, a recorded day of broadcast, but it seemed like driving in to the station from southern Brooklyn to Harlem was probably not the best move with the ice out there. It was almost 7 years ago to the week that I was actually in a nasty car accident because of what is referred to as black ice, meaning that ice you cannot see on the tarmac at all. And that was a nasty thing. I don't want to repeat it. And since we were scheduled to have a guest tonight, I didn't want her to, well, have to risk life and limb at the same time as myself. So, our guest, Nancy Hightower, will be on next week, and I'll tell you more about her in just a moment for a couple of reasons. And I will tell you that this week what we're going to do is we're going to listen to an interview conducted last March at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, where we hold our readings, which, again, I'm going to talk about momentarily, with Ken Liu, that's L-I-U, who is one of the most brilliant writers out there today. So, our guest tonight was to have been Nancy Hightower, and she will be with us next week. Now, it just so happens that Nancy Hightower and D.T. Friedman, Danielle T. Friedman, both doctors, one a medical doctor, the other Ph.D., will be our readers at the next New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. And while I will give you more information about this next week, well, I'll mention it this week as well. The date for that event will be Tuesday, February 4th, at the aforementioned Soho Gallery for Digital Art, which is also now sometimes known as the Soho Art House, where Gallery Lala is doing a market from Thursdays through the weekend, an artisan's market, something I want to check out. At any rate, Tuesday the 4th, doors opening 6:30, event begins 7 o'clock, give or take. Admission is free, donations accepted, and the venue is located at 138 Sullivan Street between Houston and Prince. And let me read you their bios. D.T. Friedman is a writer whose work has appeared in venues such as Shimmer Magazine, Flash Fiction Online, and the Dark Faith Anthology. She is a member of the Codex Writers Group and is the newest member of Altered Fluid. In her other life, she is a doctor of internal medicine with a specialization in urban underserved populations, and she's about to take a fellowship position in palliative medicine at Massachusetts General Hospital, you know, slumming. She is currently doing research on sickle cell disease, writing a novel, and taking some classes towards an MBA degree. She lives with a neurotic calico named Spoon Avocado. This is her brother's fault. Sometimes she also juggles fire. That's her official bio. And if you're listening, by the way, oh, maybe about 2 months ago, she read a short story on the air that I thought was just wonderful. And next week's guest and our other reader on February 4th is Nancy Hightower. And her short fiction and poetry has been published in Strange Horizons, Word Riot, Story South, Gargoyle, Electric Velocipede, Interfictions, Prick of the Spindle, and Up the Staircase Quarterly, among others. Her debut novel, Elementary Rising, came out with Pink Narcissus Press in 2013, and her website is nancyhightower.com. So that's going to be our guest next week, and that's also who's going to be reading at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings. Now, last March at the NYRSF Readings, we had an Oz event tying into the, oh, some anniversary or other, plus the big Sam Raimi movie that was an Oz prequel. And We had very good people, Robin Wasserman and Ken Liu. And having Ken was a big, big deal. And you will understand why when you start to hear the interview. Ken came in about 3:30 before the reading was to begin. As mentioned, we started about 6:30. We opened the doors and all that. And we recorded for about an hour and 10 minutes. And it was thoroughly fascinating, not only because he's such a good writer and interesting person, but because we got into what I consider a thoroughly fascinating discussion about translations and idioms and things like that. And translations, by the way, are something that Ken Liu does a great deal of. If you check out the podcast, which, by the way, I'm now the host of, at lightspeedmagazine.com, you will find three or four translations of stories that Ken has done. And getting good modern science fiction from China is something that probably would not be happening on the same kind of basis were he not involved. So, having said that, set your Wayback Machine for last March, first Tuesday in March, whatever date that was, and we will hear that interview with Ken Liu.
I always start by slating things. Today is March 6th, and it's about 3:30 in the afternoon, and we are in the Soho Gallery of Digital Art, the dungeon or basement of the Soho Gallery. And we are me, Jim Freund, and with me, Ken Liu. And this would have been way cool, but after the Nebula nominations, it got way cooler.
It still feels pretty cool.
Yeah, I would think so. I would think so. But just as aside from, forget awards, especially for short story writers. They are great. They are good. But short story writers are a specific breed. They are obviously doing it for the love, because most short story writers can command, what, $50 a story or something like that.
It's not much.
Yeah, they're not making a living at it. Nobody really is. But now add in the awards. And as far as I know, you may be the only person to win, in essence, the triple or quadruple crown last year in awards.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Yeah, so the short story Paper Menagerie, I'm doing this without looking at notes, Paper Menagerie won the Hugo Award, which is a fan award, the Nebula Award, which is a peer award, the World Fantasy Award, which is a judged award, the I Loved It Award from Jim.
I love that one.
IO9 played it up. Were there any other awards for Paper Menagerie?
That is, as far as I know, it. Of course, you know, the love and appreciation from the fans is probably the best award.
Yeah, yeah, and the ability to just get the damn stuff published.
Yes.
And that was, like, cool enough and good enough, but then this year, as of this recording, under 2 weeks ago, the Nebula nominations, that's the peer award from the Science Fiction Fantasy Writers of America, came out. And there are only four categories of a proper Nebula Award. We're not counting the Bradbury Award for Script and the Andre Norton for YA. They are novel, novelette, novella, and short story. And Ken didn't write a novel last year, but you're nominated in every other category.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible.
It really is.
I'm sort of blown away.
Yeah, that I don't think is a first. I think Swanwick.
I'm sure that's been done.
Michael Swanwick. Yeah, but whenever I interview Swanwick, well, one time I specifically interviewed Swanwick and said, Michael Swanwick has been nominated for more stories and awards than any other writer in SF history, which is true. To which Michael said, which means I've lost more often than any other writer in history.
The humble man.
But, I mean, that's pretty cool.
Thank you. Yeah, it's very cool.
Yeah, it has helped that they've changed how stories are nominated and all that, and we're not going to get into what that is. But as of about 3 years ago, I would say the Nebula Awards became more diversified, so it wasn't the same eight guys, and by guys I mean men, being with the exception of Le Guin,
right,
being nominated over and over and over again.
Yeah, that was an issue.
Yeah, and that has really opened up. And in addition to simply being a great writer, if that weren't enough, you are also one of the very few that I can think of Asian writers publishing in science fiction. And I don't know how many I can name. I know Ted Chiang, I've met him at mm-hmm. ReaderCon. But he was elusive. I didn't get to interview him. There's you. There's Charles Yu.
Yep.
Is it?
Yep.
Who's a really good writer.
Amazing, really.
Yeah. Yeah, he really is. I loved his... Mm-hmm. I haven't read his newest novel, just out, his last one.
Yes, the first. Yep.
The first one from about a year and a half ago was just blew me away. It was so mm-hmm. much fun. And there's another writer who had, as far as I know, only had a couple of short stories published, but one of them was wonderful. It was actually turned into a new Twilight Zone. That would be the second of the three by George R.R. Martin. It was called something like Blank Blank's Magical Emporium, using the old trope of people going into a shop, that Brigadoon-like shop that isn't right. always there, in Chinatown in an unnamed city, and finding what they're looking for, even if they didn't know that's what they were looking for in life.
Mm-hmm.
Can you name
Asian writers? There's a bunch of...
In English.
Right, there's a bunch of new ones who are coming, just starting to publish, and who are doing really great work. There's Wesley Chu, whose novel's coming out with Angry Robot Books, and... Zhang Chu, who just had a great story published at Tor.com. It's amazing. Very beautiful.
Is that
CHU.
CHU, okay.
Yep. Yeah. So, there seem to be more science fiction, fantasy writers of Asian descent.
Emerging.
Ali, of course, has been doing amazing work in short fiction. Her stuff is just poetic, lyrical, unbelievable stuff.
Yeah. And it's always wonderful to see these breakthroughs. I was in the same place in about the year 2000 with black writers. And I could only name about six or seven, and that was more than most people could name. And then Cherie Renee Thomas came out with her book Dark Matter, which not only showed a lot of the writers who have been out there, but just unsung, but also opened the field.
Right.
The presence of that book was a breakthrough
mm-hmm.
book. And I think that book alone has started, as in the 70s, we had women finally publishing under their own names without, UK Le Guin.
Sure.
Or
sort of pen name that's hard to identify explicitly as female.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, usually it was two letters
right,
and
right.
last name.
Yep,
and yes, Ursula did actually publish once as UK Le Guin in, of all places, Playboy
of course,
magazine.
Yes.
Yeah, it had
famous
to be.
One, yeah.
Had to be. And so things are changing, which science fiction is supposed to be about the future.
Mm-hmm.
It's supposed to be about being inclusive. Of course, there's lots of military SF, there's lots of right-wing SF and libertarian and stuff like that. But I like the more progressive.
Well, I think actually you can probably find all kinds of political views in science fiction, and that adds to the fun of it.
Yeah.
It's a debate.
And then talking outside, we're going to get to talking about your writing in just a bit.
Mm-hmm.
But I just wanted to discuss the field and the whole Asian aspect of it, because it's rare that I get to do this. Otherwise, I'm taking listener calls, and it's like nobody out there can call and say, oh, no, I'm doing this, or anything like that. It just hasn't happened. And very important because you're a translator. Asian writers in other languages. And I just remembered the great Japanese writer, Kobo Abe.
Mm-hmm.
I had neglected to mention him. And he's one of the great writers of science fiction, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Although not a current one. I believe he's passed on.
I'm not sure either. I'll believe you.
Yeah, but sure people can look it up. His last name is A-B-E, and if you find something of him, read it. But stuff is surely being published, or I hope it's just being published, in other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And where English is not the first language, which means that it ends up not even being the second, third, or fourth. It's just not getting sold and brought into, well, from our point of view here, it's not just English, but the United States and the
right.
U.S. market.
Right.
You are a translator.
Yep.
Which is a favorite topic of mine.
Really? How come?
I guess it has to do with that all-inclusive kind of thing. It's just that, you know, without a good translator, who would know here of Stanislaw Lem?
Mm.
How would we know of Boris and Arkady Strugatsky, whose book Roadside Picnic was turned into the movie Stalker by Andrei Tarkovsky? And I read that book maybe 30 years ago, but it was very choppy, and I thought, gee, these guys aren't really great writers, are they? And a new translation of that same book came out last summer.
That made a huge difference.
They are now being heralded in the U.S. and England
right.
as being masters of prose,
mm-hmm.
which, of course, they were in mm-hmm. their native Russian. So, also, I've had on the program several times Michael Kandel, although not in a while. He's with the MLA, the Modern Language Association,
yep.
and he's done a lot of translations of lesser known than Lem Polish writers.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I was a kid, I was reading Judith Merrill's Best of books, which were competing with like the Terry Carr books in that era. And she went to the trouble of getting people who read other languages to get short stories and include.
Mm-hmm.
So by including stuff from other cultures, and after all, we're dealing with a kind of literature that's supposed to deal with the alien,
right,
off planet, but let's deal with alien, he said, wiggling his fingers, mm-hmm. on planet,
mm-hmm.
and different cultural points of view. It's why I think that I don't think the question is why am I interested in translations and the quality thereof. The question is why isn't everybody?
That's a good question.
I mean, what would we do without great people who worked with Borges or Isaac Bashevis Singer? We're naming some of the great writers of the world.
Mm-hmm.
I am. I'm talking all the time. You're not saying much. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I'm fascinated by the discussion. But
yeah. Now, yeah, but I'm just prattling on here, and we're here for you. So, what is it actually that you translate? What is it that part of your job entails?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I started doing translations not by conscious choice. Basically, my friend Chen Qiufan, who also sometimes goes by the English name Stanley Chan, had a story that he got a translation into English, and he asked me to take a look at it and see what I thought. The translation was...
Is he an English speaker?
He speaks English very well, but, you know, he's not a native speaker. He writes
yeah.
in Chinese. And Chen Qiufan is a very prominent young, up-and-coming, actually I would say established by now, science fiction writer in China, one of the most popular of our generation. And he's done a lot of great work. So one of his stories was he had somebody translating to English, and he wanted me to take a look at the draft. And I agreed. And I just thought the translation was competent, but not really effective. It was technically accurate in a lot of places, but not well done. It didn't convey what was unique about his voice and what was interesting about his particular way of phrasing things accurately. You might go to a dictionary and say that everything was translated correctly, but it didn't read well. So yeah. I started editing it and sort of giving him suggestions on things that I wanted to change. And the thing is, after a while, I realized that I was really just rewriting the whole thing, and it would be so much easier if I just did the translation myself. So I did it. And
and it helps not a small amount that you're a good writer.
And I'm going to talk about that. Actually, it's kind of an interesting point. So the story ended up that I translated, it's called The Fish of Li Jiang. And it's a science fiction, near future, semi-dystopian tale with a very sarcastic, funny protagonist who has a very strong voice. And that story was sold to Clark's World and ended up winning the Fantasy and Science Fiction Translation Award, which was very pleasing to both Stanley and me.
I'm sorry, who gives that out?
That's given out. I can look it up. It's the world. I think it's called the Science Fiction and Fantasy Translation Foundation.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll have to look them up.
Yeah. It's a beautiful. They do a great job of recognizing translations, because I think oftentimes we don't really pay enough attention to translations. Period. Like you were saying, and it's great that there's an award established to recognize that. So. Anyway, so that's how I got started. And after that, I realized that I'm sort of in an interesting position, because there's a lot of really great, wonderful science fiction and fantasy being written in Chinese, and almost none of it is known to the West, because they're not translating to English. And because they're not translating to English, most readers in the United States and England and other Anglophone countries just don't know about their existence at all, let alone appreciating them. So I thought that because I do know these works, and I think I'm somewhat competent at translating, I would make more of an effort to bring more of them into English. So since then, I've done a bunch of translations of short fiction by various writers like Xia Jia and Ma Boyong and other Chinese writers who are very well known in China, but not so much here in the West. And the stories I've translated have generally been well received. And so I'm glad to see that my instinct was right, and that great literature gets appreciated everywhere, regardless of the language, and that these barriers of culture and language can be overcome with an effective translation. So now onto your point about translation. I think translation is a very interesting topic, especially when you're talking about translation of science fiction and fantasy, because a lot of times people feel that science fiction, especially, should be easier to translate in some sense than other types of literature, because the idea is...
That's not the assumption I would make, because new concepts...
Well, actually, this is why people make that assumption, because the global language of science is English. So when you're talking about new concepts and new technical terms...
That's funny, the lingua franca?
Yes, exactly. these new concepts and new terms are almost always expressed in English and then borrowed and translated into the various languages that the scientists are speak natively. So the terms that are science fictional, genetic engineering, transgenetic crops, artificial intelligence, that sort of thing. When you go to other languages, you find that their terms for these concepts are basically translations of the English terms. So, because English is the global language of science. So, the natural assumption is, well, since all these terms are derived from English, then it should be easy to translate back and forth, because they're all sort of, it's sort of like that old joke where you think when you're a kid, you think that people who speak other languages are not really speaking other languages, they're just speaking English, only with a weird, different accent. And so that's sometimes how people sort of perceive science fiction. But in practice, that's not true. Those technical terms and the technical concepts turn out to be the easiest things to translate when you're going between languages for speculative fiction. What's much harder to get across are the humanistic aspects behind the science fiction. You know, science fiction isn't just about let's come up with a big idea about how to save humanity against some impending disaster, or you know, how to deal with an alien invasion. There's that part of it is interesting for readers, but to me, the much more interesting stuff is how different cultures and different writers who write in different languages deal with the human drama behind these concepts very differently. Because even though science fiction and fantasy are about, you know, imaginative worlds, the very human emotions are drawn from the writer's real experiences, and they're intended for a readership in that language, in that culture, who share certain assumptions. And when you're trying to do translation, you realize how much slippage there is and how much a lot of these things are different between the various cultures and languages, and things that are assumed to be true or that are naturally true for one author and one readership are not true when translating to a different language and for different readers. So it's been actually quite challenging to make this work. And I think a good translator, you know, people sometimes emphasize how a good translator has to have a good understanding of the source language and have really good intimate understanding of the nuances of the source language. And that's true, but I think not enough emphasis is placed on the ability of the translator to express concepts in the target language. So in some sense, I would say that a good translator is not necessarily someone who really, 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 really understands the source language and culture in such detail that he can be considered a scholar, but rather someone who has the necessary skills as a writer in the target language to convey what nuances he can understand in an effective way. It doesn't do any good for somebody who is a scholar of the source culture and the source language if that person is unable to express with subtlety and with grace in the target language, because all that understanding is sort of wasted. So I think people should place more emphasis, or at least equal emphasis, on the ability of the translator to write, because translation really is not about blindly finding synonyms and putting them down on paper in a different language, but rather recreating one piece of art in a different language, culture, context for a different readership, and to do it in a way that balances fidelity to the source as well as expressiveness and beauty of language in the new work of art. Translation really, a good translator, in my opinion, really should treat his work as an act of creation, and really believe that you know, he or she is trying to create a new piece of art that's based on the original, sort of like a sketch, not a photographic copy.
Yeah. So therefore, it sounds like from what you're saying that it's really a collaboration.
Yes, actually, I would say that the best translations result from a good collaborative working relationship between the translator and the author.
Mm-hmm.
Because surprisingly, there can be a lot of conflicts between what the author intended and what the translator thinks will work. Because there are certain, you know, this probably is familiar to a lot of writers. You write a story, and there are some aspects of the story that's very important to you, and then you show it to beta readers, and the readers get a totally different sort of meaning, sense out of it than what the writer intended. That actually happens quite a lot between authors and translators. The author...
That actually happens quite a lot between authors and readers.
Right. Exactly. That's the part that I think people understand. But between author and translator, there's a similar dynamic. The author intends certain things that are very important, or he thinks are very important to the story, that he thinks are critical to the work of art he created. But when translating to a new context, those may not be the very same aspects that are of interest or important to the target readership. There are certain things that the source audience takes for granted and therefore draws meaning from certain things. But the target readership would have a different set of assumptions and different semantic associations and different emotional responses. And you kind of have to balance that. I'm not advocating that people should take the source and just sort of use it as a blueprint while you write a new story based on it. That's not what I'm advocating. The translator has to be faithful above all to the original art, because, you know, the reader is here to read to get some sense of the original, not to read your interpretation. But in some ways you can't get away from the fact that you will have to do some interpreting, and yet you have to balance between this desire to be faithful to the original vision and at the same time not make it so alien, so divorced from the target culture language that it becomes inaccessible. So it's a hard balancing act.
It must be very difficult, because I'm thinking that as a writer yourself, in interpreting this other person's work, all of a sudden people are reading something of another writer, and it's like, ooh, well, there's sort of a trope that Ken Liu has used.
Right, exactly. That's the sort of thing you want to avoid, right? You don't want to be... So I think a translator would be a failure if he or she translates a bunch of stories by different writers, and then the reader reads them and says, they all sound the same.
It's happened in movies. Steven Spielberg just announced that he's doing another Stanley Kubrick script. He had already done AI,
yep,
which Kubrick was developing actually with a couple of science fiction writers, including, I think, Ian Watson and Brian Aldiss in England.
Mm-hmm.
And then he died at age 70, and Spielberg made the movie. And there are parts that are Kubrickian.
Yes, exactly. You feel like there are parts that are very Kubrickian, but ultimately,
it's a Spielberg film.
Yes, exactly.
And so now Spielberg is doing Kubrick's, I think it's, is it Napoleon as a miniseries?
I think so, yeah.
And it's going to be Spielberg. My point is that not even Spielberg, and you know, he had this dilemma. I read interviews with him that I thought were very interesting, that he didn't know whether he had to be true to his abilities as a great movie maker, or if he had to try to ape who he considered one of his role models and gods in movie making,
right.
Kubrick. And you know, nobody can make a Kubrick film but Kubrick. People have tried for decades. They can't do it, and neither could Spielberg. So he ended up doing a Spielberg film.
Right.
So it must be a very, very difficult line to walk.
Yeah, it's a very difficult line to walk. And in fact, you know, there's also the added layer that I've had a lot of my stories in English translating to Chinese. So I know very well how this feels from the other side, when you're the author and somebody else is doing the translation, and you can understand the translation and you sort of see what choices the translator made, and you sort of decide whether you agree or don't agree. And the thing is, the first few times it happens, I think as an author you tend to be extremely protective of your work. At least I was. The first few times I was translated, I was very protective, and I wanted to, the translator would make a decision, and I would agonize over it, and I would be like, okay, is this choice faithful to what I wanted to do? Do I still feel, after this decision has been made, this is still my story, or do I feel it's no longer mine? So I agonize over a lot of these kind of choices, and so I know how it feels from the other side. So when I'm doing the translation, usually, because I know the original writers, I'm very respectful of these issues. So if I make a decision that I think is pretty substantive and big, I would try to run it by the author and try to explain why.
If you can. I mean, the problem is that...
Right, not always possible.
Spielberg can't talk to
exactly,
Spielberg.
Exactly. Well, if it is possible, I would try to talk to the author and try to explain why I think a particular decision needs to be made, why this passage needs to be moved or perhaps even removed, and why perhaps we should add a phrase or a sentence here to explain things or to even change the emphasis a little bit for an Anglophone readership. And but over time, I've come to realize that people sort of focus a lot on this concept of lost in translation, the idea being that there's lots of nuances and meanings in the original that are lost when the translation happens. And that is true. That is true. That's inevitable. It's not possible to translate one work of art in a way that preserves every single nuance of the original.
No, it cannot be done.
It's just kind of be done. I can give you a very simple example that will illustrate the point. So, for example, you know, take the word for God in Chinese, which is Shangdi. By God, I mean the Judeo-Christian concept of God. When, mm-hmm. In the West, when we say God in a capitalized G, that's usually what we mean. In China, the equivalent is Shangdi, which is a term with a very, very complicated history. Shangdi is not a neologism. It's not a new word. It's not invented in Chinese in some recent year. It's an ancient word that existed since, you know, the days of the Oracle script. And it referred to the supreme being of the universe, this formless, not man-shaped kind of supreme being. And later on during Confucianism, it became sort of identified as the source and the basis for legitimacy of imperial rule. So Shangdi literally means supreme emperor. Well, actually, the term emperor is a little problematic because Chinese
well, that's the point. We're talking about idioms here, so you can't say it in English.
The Chinese term for that's usually translating to English as emperor is not obviously emperor. So the point is, Shangdi had this very long history of a certain meaning. And then the Jesuit priests during the Ming Dynasty, when they went to China, wanted to convert locals into Christianity. And the way they did it was the Jesuits were mainly accommodationists, cultural accommodationists. They believed that to make Christianity effective as a religion in China, you had to sort of adopt Christian concepts to suit cultural practices that are local to China and not impose European ideals onto the Chinese, which put the Jesuits into a lot of conflict with the Pope back in Rome. But anyway, the point is...
And a lot of missionaries historically would find the local gods wherever they were and turn those gods into the devils.
Right. And
you see, ours is better.
Right. And the Jesuits actually did something...
You want to use Android, not Apple.
Right, exactly. And the Jesuits were actually very interesting. They took the term Shangdi and said, okay, so we're going to take this approach, which is that the Chinese culture is very ancient and learned, and we're not going to fight them on this point. What we're going to say is that just kind of like, you know, sort of like the old classical philosophers of Greece, they were pagans, but they in their writings and in their philosophy, you could see echoes of later Christian concepts. Mm-hmm. So in some way, the Platonic ideas and these Greek philosophers were really talking about Christian concepts. They just didn't know that Christ was coming. So they took a similar approach to the Chinese classics, and they said that, you know, if you study the Confucian classics very deeply, you will see that there are echoes of later Christian doctrines coming. So it's not that we're teaching you something completely new. We're just trying to teach you to understand your own classics better, to see how they fit into the Christian view. And so they translate, one of the earliest missionaries made the decision to translate God as Shangdi, to identify God with the supreme being that had been existent in Chinese culture forever. And this was a very controversial decision. You know, it caused a lot of controversy back in Rome, a lot of controversy in China.
Yeah.
Like, is this a proper translation? You know, this is sort of, you know, it's fascinating to think about how these translation matters have always been, you know, points of contention throughout history. So, anyway, the point is, eventually, Shangdi did become the term for God. And this imported Western idea that identified the Judeo-Christian God with Chinese Shangdi actually took over and became the dominant meaning.
Yeah.
So the Chinese no longer think of Shangdi in the classical ancient sense of, you know, supreme being of classical ancient Chinese worship, but rather when they speak of Shangdi in modern Chinese, most Chinese would picture the guy with the white robe and the white beard.
Yeah,
pretty similar to what we you know, think as children, as
and such is the nature of imperialism wherever it derives from.
Sure. So what I'm getting at is when a story I translated by the Chinese novelist Liu Cixin, he had a story called Shanyang Shangdi, which literally translates as taking care of God, which is what I ended up using as the title. There's a lot of complexities to that. To those layers of meaning, because when a Chinese person reads Shangdi, what he's thinking about is there's this entire history of Western missionaries in China, and the entire history of how Christianity first tried to accommodate to Chinese culture and later became very oppositional to it, and how it became the ideology of the revolutionaries. You know, very important revolutionaries, Feng Xiuquan, Sun Yat-sen, all these people embraced Christianity as a way to change the traditions of China. So,
yeah.
So when you talk about Shangdi in China, there's a definitive sense, a certain emotional reaction, and a certain kind of association with the word that is just absent when you talk about God to a reader in the United States or England or Australia, who, you know, would each have slightly different reactions to it, but it's certainly not the same as the Chinese reader's reaction to Shangdi.
Yeah.
So, similarly, Shanyang, the other term in the title, has no exact English equivalent. It refers to a Confucian ideal about the duty of a child to take care of his or her parent in old age.
Wow. Okay.
And you know, we don't really have an English.
So a two-word title,
right,
has two idiomatic issues,
yes,
not one.
Exactly. There are many layers,
and they're very important.
They're very important. There are many layers of complexity to this. So a Chinese reader reading Shanyang Shangdi has a definite emotional reaction right away to it that an English reader just won't get. But here's what's important. Lots of stuff is lost in translation in the sense of meanings, emotional reactions, and all these semantic associations that are present for the original readership will not be present in the new readership. But what's important is don't focus only on what's being lost. Let's focus also on what's being gained.
Yes.
There's a lot gained in translation as well. The fact is, you know, when I translated that story over into English, which is, so I'll give you a brief synopsis of the story, and this is a story that you can read online now because it's been published. So taking care of God is about the idea that one day aliens, essentially, came to Earth and claimed that they were actually God, in the sense that they created human beings.
Mm-hmm.
That is, they're a star-faring civilization who long ago came to Earth.
And by the way, hi to Eric Van Dunneken.
So right.
Back to sorry.
The story. So they came to Earth a long time ago and engineered the biosphere and manipulated history to basically create Earth civilization. And now that they've been wandering the stars for millennia, they're old and they're in their dotage and they no longer can take care of themselves. So they came back to Earth and said, you know, you're our children and we created you a long time ago, but now we're old and we no longer have the ability to take care of ourselves. Would you take care of us and let us live with you?
Which is actually very much the way generations tend to work.
Yep.
Parents need their children to take care of them,
right,
when they reach a certain point.
That's right. So so the story is, you know, about this, how Earthlings react to this news and how they treat these former creators of theirs now that they're no longer powerful and they're in their dotage and they need help. So the story, you know, has a lot of resonance for Chinese audiences because the whole idea of taking care of your aged parents is coming to conflict with a mobile modern society in which, you know, children no longer live with their parents and they pursue careers that take them away from home and so on and so forth, where the extended family is breaking down into the nuclear family, etc. So there's a lot of complexity and resonance for a Chinese readership. But in English, it's surprising how effective the story still works. And it works, it's affecting in a different way because the English reader isn't reacting to the same cultural background and the same nuances that were present in the Chinese original, but they're reacting to different emotional echoes and different nuances that are present for us. You know, we have our family relationships in the West that are very different. We have issues about you know, what do we do with people who, as we engage in these end-of-life medical practices that extend their life on and on to the point where the quality of life has, you know, declined greatly. What is our moral responsibility and what is, you know, the right thing to do? And what is our emotional reaction to this sort of problem? And for the West, which is, you know, has always had this very strong emphasis on individualism and progress, or at least that is the ideological interpretation, which
yes.
people may dispute. How do you balance that with this obligation towards the past, this duty towards, you know, people who have a claim on your past, on where you came from? For the English reader, it turns out that the story is effective, but not at all in the same way that the Chinese story is effective. It's a different twist, it's a different reaction, and it's a different emphasis. I found it fascinating that essentially the story in English is a different story that is clearly based on the Chinese original, but not the same one. It revealed aspects of the original that were not so obvious in the Chinese original, and sort of brought into the open a lot of meanings that I had not thought about. And this whole idea about, you know, how would you deal with a literal interpretation of Judeo-Christianity, the creation myth, that is taking this very science fictional twist? What is, in fact, you know, the story goes on to posit.
It's like the polar opposite of James Mora,
right? Right.
In which God dies and falls into
right.
the ocean and has to be towed away by the
right.
Exxon Valdez.
Right. Exxon Valdez. I mean, the story posits that, you know, that humans are not alone, but in fact, these creatures who claim to be God created multiple other planets, and they went to all of them to ask to be taken in. So it's sort of like a Lear story in a way as well.
Yeah.
So
which again, planets of among you love me the
right,
best?
Right. And there's this kind of
that's really, a fascinating.
It's a fascinating kind of to see how a translated work fits into a new, different ecosystem of literary references and causes different reactions to
yeah.
the reader.
And the cultural differences in there.
Right.
It gives the story new life in a way.
Exactly. It gives
so
story new
loss
life.
In translation, but here's a new concept added in translation.
Yes. So
but while keeping the purity of the author's
exactly,
concept.
Exactly. And
wow.
I think people should embrace that. The fact that you can be a total purist in the sense of when you're reading a translation, you're not reading the original. So you're not going to experience the same work as the original.
Yeah, I know too many people who say, oh, no, I'm not going to read that book unless I can learn the language.
Right.
There are people who do just that.
Right, right. And that's a perfectly respectable view.
And I do watch movies only in their original language, but I do depend on the subtitles. But I want to hear the intonation of the actors.
Mm-hmm.
I want to get both, and very often I will, over time, I will have learned enough French, enough German, enough whatever, to say, wait a minute, that's not what that actor just said, is it?
Right, right. Wait, that's not that's not what the subtitles really say.
Yeah,
right.
And it could be that the subtitle, watching a Russian science fiction movie, Kinzaza, wonderful, weird little movie.
I haven't seen it. Okay.
Oh, yeah, it's worth seeing. And I had a translation in English, and one of the characters exclaimed something in Russian, and the subtitle said, "Crikey!"
You're like, that can't be really what they said.
And it's like, okay, number one, now we know more about the translator than we did about
right.
the movie.
Right.
He's Australian.
Right. And you wonder, what was the original idiom that got translated?
Exactly.
Right.
And that in and of itself was funny. The problem was it also took me out of the movie.
Right.
It also took me out of the story. Thank God it's a light comedy.
Right.
But the, with sort of Douglas Adams overtones, so it had a very serious aspect underneath it. But therein lies the fun
yep.
in and the problem itself of being taken out of the piece in order to deal with the different iterations
yes.
it has had.
Yes.
There was. A Japanese version of The Borrowers made recently by Ghibli, I can't say it right, Studios.
Studios, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, The Borrowers became renamed, as it often does, The Secret Life of Arrietty. And there is a British dubbed version and an American dubbed version. They're totally different. Same animation, same story, and God knows what the language of the Japanese version is.
Mm-hmm.
But just watching the English versus the American, hearing the English versus the American voiceovers,
mm-hmm.
Makes me want to see the movie with subtitles.
It's different, right?
And hear the original actors.
Yeah, that's totally true. So anyway, I think people should try to embrace the fact that a translation is a new work of art, and it will not be a total preservation of the original, but it will be a different work and quite interesting in itself.
And I am interrupting this interview with Ken Liu to tell you that this is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and over WBAI.org. And this is a pre-recorded program allowing for snow and ice, traveling from Brooklyn to Harlem did not seem like the wisest move, parking and different issues. I'm calling this the Snowy Owl Edition. Snowy because, well, in New York City we had a good almost 10 inches of snow. Owl Edition because of the hour, and the Snowy Owl Edition because, well, there's snowy owls all over the New York, New Jersey area. Apparently, and I'm very tempted to go out and seek one out for advice, if nothing else. But at any rate, we are listening to an interview recorded last March with Ken Liu, that's L-I-U, and we will now continue.
Well, this is thoroughly fascinating and not only worth a show in its own, but we've spent 40 minutes on it.
Really?
Yes.
Wow,
yeah.
The time just flew by.
Yeah, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Ken Liu.
Okay.
How would you describe yourself as a writer? And I don't just mean genre. I mean
right.
Thematically, who is Ken Liu?
I'm not sure I have a good answer for that. I think in some ways I'm still trying to figure that out. Although I suppose in some way all writers are trying to figure that out. At least I think if you don't try to figure that out if you don't try to learn something new about yourself or try to do something new yourself with every work, and then you're sort of
and you're still relatively young. Your output is only just begun.
I hope I'm still young. So I'm exploring a lot of things. I'm trying to figure out what is the story that matters to me. I've had this philosophy that for some writers, maybe myself included, what they really have in them is one ideal story that they're trying to tell in various ways.
Mm-hmm.
That all of their stories can be seen as echoes of that Platonic ideal story that they have in their heads that they're trying to reach towards. So with every new story they compose, they're trying in various ways to sketch some projection of that ideal story into the world of reality, and that they may never succeed, but whatever stories they write, you can always trace them back to that ideal story in their head that they're trying to tell. And maybe that's what I'm doing, because I think there are thematic.
I think it's fair to say that when I read one of your works, I don't necessarily, circumnavigate and come to this is the theme of that writer. But I do get a sense that if somebody had ripped the cover title off of it, I might have guessed you wrote it.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I've had that happen. I mean, I participate in these fiction contests where, it's just a group of writers trying to critique each other's work and submit stories on a theme anonymously, so we can all sort of comment on each other and without the friendships and the reputations getting in the way. And I have heard people say that my stories are very identifiable even without my name on there, that they can tell it's my story even though my name is not on there. So there is a sense in which that kind of thematic sort of voice presence is pretty strong.
I've had interviews with writers where I said, "Oh, you've got a new book out. Come on, let's do a show." And they say, "Well, it's not science fiction." It's like, "Yeah, So, it's like it's still your work,
right?
Right? It's still a part of the body of what you have done. And lo and behold, I get to read that work, and even though it's not within the genre, I can tell it's from that writer, and I can tell that it's within that person's body of work.
Right.
And so, what's the theme? In your case, it's Ken Liu.
I hope it's not all Ken Liu all the time. But
getting back to, now I don't dare say the Chinese name for God, Shandi. Shandi.
Uh-huh.
As somebody might say that, and that's sort of an idiomatic word.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say that in this sense, Ken Liu is an idiomatic concept that can be found in different stories. How's that?
Okay. That is probably a little more palatable. I don't know if there's a way to put what I...
I'm sorry, but listeners should see how pleased I am with myself. Go on.
Thank you. That was actually very well done. I don't know if I can put into words what my thematic concerns are, but there's a sense in which I'm trying to figure out... science fiction often is described as being very concerned with the future, but I'm not sure my work is very... much in that vein. I certainly talk a lot about the future and the meaning of technology and how technology changes concepts that we take for granted and how it changes what it means to be human. But a lot of my stories, I think, have this very deep sort of lingering sense of being concerned with the past in the context of the future. That is, as we're talking about progress, future inventions, and solving our problems of the present day with technology, there's also a sense in which my stories are really very much looking backwards and looking into history and trying to figure out what does the experience of our parents, our grandparents, and generations before mean in the context of this march towards progress. Is this really time's arrow or time's cycle? Is this really a view, a teleological view of the universe, or something more that talks about a recurring pattern, cyclical nature of history? So a lot of my stories are really centered around meditations on these different views of what it means to remember, to embrace the past at the same time that you're moving forward. Because I don't think it's possible to really talk about the future without in some way coming to terms with the past. So a lot of my stories are focused on that, on the passage of the generations, on the way things are passed from generation to generation, on the way meaning changes over time, on the way we can embrace the past while also at the same time critiquing aspects of it and make it meaningful without completely changing it. So in some ways, I guess my work is really about translation too. It's about translating the past for the future, and how to reinterpret and interpret and understand and empathize with the past at the same time that you're moving forward.
Yeah.
So that's a sort of thematic preoccupation.
Shards of reality, really, is what it comes down to,
mm-hmm.
I think,
mm-hmm.
Which is a wonderful way of looking at, well, all of it, whatever it may mean.
Whatever it means.
Yeah. Why don't you read a story for us?
Okay, I brought along...
Do you want to take a break?
I can dive right in. I think I'll be okay.
Okay, great.
Okay, so I brought along a flash piece that I wrote, which I like a lot.
And we should just explain to listeners who don't know, flash means a short story.
A very short story.
Yeah.
This one is under 1,000 words, and it was published in Daily Science Fiction, I believe, last year. And it's one of my favorite pieces.
And again, just to translate for listeners, Daily Science Fiction is a website that publishes a story a day.
Yep, and you can subscribe to it, and it's free.
Yeah.
Okay, so the story is called Memories of My Mother. Age 10. Dad greeted me at the door, nervous. Amy, look who's here. He stepped aside. She looked exactly the way she did in the pictures hung everywhere in our house. Black hair, brown eyes, smooth, pale skin. Yet she also felt like a stranger. I put down my book bag, unsure what to do. She walked over, leaned down, and hugged me, first loosely and then very tight. She smelled like a hospital. Dad had told me that the doctors had no cure for her sickness. She had only 2 years left to live. "You're so big." Her breath felt warm and tickly on my neck, and suddenly I hugged my mother back. Mom brought me presents, a dress that was too small, a set of books that were too old, a model of the rocket ship she rode in. "I was on a very long trip," she said. "The ship went so fast that time slowed down inside. Felt like only 3 months." Dad had already explained it all to me. This was how she would cheat time, stretch out her 2 years so that she could watch me grow up. But I didn't stop her. I liked listening to her voice. "I didn't know what you would like." She was embarrassed by the gifts that surrounded me. Gifts that were meant for another child, the daughter of her mind. "What I really wanted was a guitar, but Dad thought I was too young. If I had been older, I might have told her that it was all right, that I loved her gifts anyway. But I was not yet so good at lying. I asked her how long she would stay with us. Instead of answering, she said, "Let's stay up all night, and we'll do everything Dad says you can't do." We went out, and she bought me a guitar. I finally fell asleep at 7 in the morning in her lap. It was a fantastic night. When I woke up, she was gone. Age 17. "Why the hell are you here?" I slammed the door in my mother's face. "Amy." Dad opened the door again. Seeing him next to my mother, still 25, still exactly the same woman from the pictures, I suddenly realized how old he had grown. He was the one who held me when I was scared out of my wits by the blood I found in my panties. He was the one who, red-faced, mumbled to the store clerk to beg her to fit me for a bra. He was the one who stood there and held me while I screamed at him. She has no right to dip back into my life once every 7 years, like some fairy godmother. Later, she knocked on my bedroom door. I stayed in bed and said nothing. She came in anyway. She had crossed light years to get here, and a plywood door wasn't going to stop her. I liked that she pushed her way in to see me, and I also hated it. It was confusing. "That's an elegant dress," she said. My prom dress was hanging from the back of the door. It was elegant and cost me half my savings, but I had torn it carelessly near the waist. After a while, I turned around and sat up. She was in my chair, sewing. She had cut a guitar-shaped piece from her own silver dress and patched it over the tear in mine. It was perfect. "My mother died when I was a little girl," she said. "I never got to know her, so I decided that I would do something different when I found out." It was strange to hug her. She could have been my older sister. Age 38. Mom and I sat together in the park. Baby Debbie was asleep in the stroller, and Adam was with the other boys by the jungle gym, screaming with joy. "I never got to meet Scott," she said, apologetic. "You weren't dating last time I visited, during grad school." "He was a good man," I almost said. "We just grew apart." It would have been easy. I had been lying for so long to everyone, including myself. But I was tired of lying. He was an ass. It just took me years to admit it. "Love makes us do strange things," she said. Mom was only 26. When I was her age, I had been full of hope, too. Could she really understand my life? She asked me how Dad had died. I told her that he went peacefully, even if it wasn't true. There were more lines on my face than on hers, and I felt that I needed to protect her. "Let's not speak any more of sad things," she said. And I was angry with her for being able to smile, and I was also glad that she was there with me. It was confusing. So we spoke about the baby and watched Adam play until it was dark. Age 80. "Adam?" I asked. "It's hard for me to turn the wheelchair, and everything seems so dim in my eyes. It can't be Adam. He's been really busy with his new baby. Maybe it's Debbie, but Debbie never visits." "It's me," she says, and squats down before me. I squint. She looks still the same, as always. But not exactly the same. The smell of medicine is stronger than ever, and I can feel her hands are shaking. "How long have you been traveling?" I ask. "Since you started." 2 years and counting," she says. "I'm not leaving again." I'm sad to hear this, and yet I'm also happy. It's confusing. Was it worth it? I got to see less of you than most mothers, but also more. She pulls up a chair next to me, and I lean my head on her shoulder. I fall asleep, feeling very young and knowing that she'll be there when I wake up. The end.
Yeah.
That's the story.
That's, and it's a good one. It's touching.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. Which I would say most of your writing is. First of all, they're entertaining. Second of all, they're very slice of life to mm-hmm. me. I would say that's part of the voice
yes,
that you so. Share is a slice of life kind of a voice. But they're also very humane, very touching. They somehow say something.
That's a good word. Humane, I think, is what I like. I go for. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. That's good. And I really, you know, sometimes I hear a story and it's like, no, a proper interviewer should have 1,000 questions after that. And I think, you know what? I think it spoke for itself. I think it said it and, you know.
Yeah, it's a short story and it does what it, you know.
It does what it set out to
yes,
do.
Yes.
Very much so. Why do you write primarily short stories?
I don't, I didn't set out to do so.
Okay, why do you publish? That's a better way.
Okay, well, here's the real reason, which is that my wife and I have 2 very young children. And as anybody who has very young children knows, it's just not very easy to concentrate and find chunks of time where you can focus on stuff. For me,
I used to get a lot of lit when I was on it at 5 in the morning. I had a lot of young parents listening just because they had no choice
exactly.
to be awake at that hour.
Exactly. you know, for me, I've ever since my second daughter was born, I think I've ended up doing lots of flash pieces way more than I used to. And I think part of that is because that's about the length at which I can operate. So, I didn't set out explicitly to do short stories, but that's the practical answer for why that's the scope of what I do. But I am working on a novel. You know, the universe is created by my wife and I together, but this novel is going to be primarily me working within that universe. It's coming along. It's an epic fantasy set on an imaginary archipelago influenced by vaguely by East Asian cultural practices. And the technology level is somewhat pre-steam. There are gods, there's magic, there are magical creatures. Hopefully it will also be fun and entertaining for readers. I really enjoyed working something long and I've been working on this novel for a very long time. So hopefully my daughters will give me sufficient chunks of time where I can actually finish it. That's my biggest goal for the year.
Mm-hmm. And a good one. It sort of puts you in a place in where you are in your life and what you're doing, I think, just a little bit with Saladin Ahmed, who also has 2 young daughters.
That's right. That's
and
right.
And is also taking stuff from his cultural heritage,
mm-hmm.
which is arabesque.
Mm-hmm.
And putting that into a world of fantasy
yep.
with gods and
yep.
all that. And
I don't know how he does it. I mean, you know, I having 2 young children, it's just, I don't know how he managed to do it.
I don't think at this point Saladin knows how he does it either. Like, he used to be in New York, we're friends. So it's difficult. It must be very difficult. And on top of that, you're a software developer.
I do software development. My day job is actually as a litigation support company. But on the side, I do some software development.
Wow. Okay.
As part of the various things that I do. Right now, my wife and I design and write these Android and iOS apps. That are meant for our daughters.
Yeah, but you know, I had fun playing with it.
Oh, good. Thank you.
It was, well, it's interesting. You know, it's because I don't have any Mandarin. I don't have any language. I don't even, I'm of German descent. I don't even have any German. But I love the other. I love learning about what I don't know. I hope most people do.
Well, I hope most people are curious.
Many people
and
are,
interested.
Are fearful of it. I go the other way. I try to embrace it now, and then it turns out to be fearful. That's another story.
Yes, but, and that's a healthy attitude, I think.
But no, I found, you know, the sort of a mental Fisher-Price kind of thing from another world.
Sure.
But it gave me just the tiniest little insight there. Let me ask you one last question, because we're actually about out of time.
Okay.
Which is other media than the written word. Have you thought of playing in other media? And I'm very careful when I say that, because other media can be world building through software, games, cinema, theater, radio drama, he said meaningfully.
Yes, meaningfully.
Have you thought about either A, doing your own, you've written, your stuff is very easily, I think, adaptable for other media.
Oh, that's cool. I hope
because it is slice of life stuff. And
right.
And by the way, doesn't require a budget. Be great for theater. Think of it. It would be great theater.
Yeah, it's true. I haven't actually thought about theater. I have thought about film and scripts. Yeah,
that's the first thing people think of.
Yeah, that's definitely what a lot of people think about. And I mean, I admire film as a form. It's really sort of the main popular culture form that we have. I mean, you know, in terms of influence, you can't beat film.
Yeah, but you see, you're from Boston. I'm from New York. I think theater.
Okay, that's true. It depends on what you're thinking of specifically and what group you're really targeting. But, you know, I think film is fascinating. I've been interested in it for a long time, and I love to someday actually work in film in some capacity, scripting, whatever.
Directing.
Directing, yeah. So.
Well, I mean, in your case, I would think making your own movies of your own stories would be...
That would be interesting. I don't know how I feel about that. In some ways, I feel like it's almost easier to have someone else do the translation in that sense than to do it yourself.
Yeah, but if you were to take one of your stories and put it into Mandarin, would you hire somebody or would you do it?
I would... You know, I don't think I would do it myself. I think
really?
I would rely on somebody else to do it. Just because I think, philosophies on this probably differ. But I think, actually, that it's better to have some... Again, you know, this goes to the fact of whether how expressive you can be in the target language. I don't live in China, so I no longer have an ear for the dialogue of everyday life. I no longer have a sense of the way people use slang and the way that they're, you know, these things change on a minute-by-minute basis.
Yeah, absolutely.
You really have to be embedded in the culture to really have the full panoply of tools at your disposal. And so I've seen my own work translated by very skilled translators who are also writers. I mean, Xia Jia, who is one of the Chinese writers I've translated into English before, and she herself is also a very accomplished translator into Chinese. So she took one of my stories and did the translation into Chinese. And I read her
that
translation.
That makes a lot of sense, what you're saying.
Yes.
It really does.
And I read her translation, and then my response was, there's no way I could have ever done what she did. Because what she did is she took my original, and then she recreated it in a much more vivid, lively, new way. Her
into a language that would be meaningful for the
that's
Chinese
right,
readers.
That's right. Her Chinese translation is
yours would probably be more classical.
Her translation is lively. It's filled with the ear of the market. It's fresh. People talking different voices. There's just a real, you know, liveliness to it that I can't possibly approach because I don't live there on a day-to-day basis.
So in the same context, then, you might want to turn something you've written over to a director.
Exactly.
Who is already versed
exactly
in the tricks of cinema and film.
That's right. That's right.
This is, again, as you were saying earlier, it is all about translation,
right,
isn't it?
And it's about adding to it, not just preserving the original. You know, you can't go into a translation effort, whether it's translating to film or translating to another language, with the idea that the goal here is to preserve as much of the original as possible. That I think always leads to a horrible result. I mean, when you do good film adaptations, what's critical is whether the film, the translation to film, takes advantage of the unique properties of film to do something about that story that's new and interesting and fresh, not about preserving slavishly every aspect of the original written word. And I think that applies in translation.
Well, I'm glad that I opened this conversation and themed it to discussing translation and using that, not only because it was just fascinating, but using that also as a leverage to discussing your work and your writing, because you've given me, I was already interested in translation, now I'm becoming fixated after this conversation, because you've expressed the concept of translation almost as a philosophy of looking at cultural aspects of the world.
Yeah, I kind of agree with that, yes.
And I'm going to take that to heart.
Well, thank you.
Well, on that note, I think we're going to end this part of the interview, and I hope that we get to do more.
Thank you. I really enjoyed this.
I mean, we only scratched the surface of things we can talk about.
Right.
We haven't discussed the meanings of paper menagerie or any of that stuff, but it was wonderful.
This was a fun conversation. I really had
it. And I can't thank you enough for being here.
Well, thank you very much, Jim.
And you have been listening to an interview with Ken Liu, LIU, conducted last March at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art in the basement, just before we had done a New York Review of Science Fiction reading based on Oz. I had mentioned at the top of the show, by the way, that this was to coincide with the release of that new movie that Sam Raimi put out. And I finally saw it, and you know what? It sucked. I mean, I like Sam Raimi movies for their cheesiness and their fun and all that. And this story, it just had no life to it whatsoever. The China Doll was great, and beyond that, no big deal. But Ken Liu was certainly fascinating and interesting, and I'm very grateful to him for having taken the time out to record that additional interview, and hopefully our paths will cross again somewhere soon. You can find him online, Google his name up, again, Ken, and then LIU, and I can also recommend that there are a few podcasts of readings of Ken Liu's work and his translations. I believe at both Clark's World magazine, where Kate Baker does the readings, and at Lightspeed magazine, where recently I have become the host. But just Google it up and let the hits fall where they may. And I should outro the whole thing properly, saying that this is Hour of the Wolf, over listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM, and over WBAI.org. And my name is Jim Freund. This is the 42nd, more or less, anniversary of this program. Margot Adler began Hour of the Wolf in January of 1972. And she did the show 5 days a week. I was her co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, which were the science fiction mornings. And sometime about approximately 2 years later, I had taken the show over. And Margot, of course, now is mostly with NPR, but also turning out books and appearing in any number of places, and hopefully is going to be on the program in the next month or so. She has a new book coming out called Vampires Are Us. And you may have heard me play her sermon. She calls it her vampire sermon on vampires in politics and today's culture. And it's not as obvious as you would think. Any more than when she wrote the definitive book on neo-paganism, Drawing Down the Moon, people said, oh, it's about witches. No, it's not what you think. So, nevertheless, the point is that this is an anniversary of sorts for the program. We'll keep celebrating it next week because we're not sure which day the program began. We just know that it began in January of 1972, and we're going to leave it at that. So, next week on Hour of the Wolf, my guest is going to be Nancy Hightower, and she's a fascinating writer. She has her doctorate, I forget in what exactly, but suffice it to say that it involves mythology and fantasy and things like that, and she will be reading from her debut novel, Elementary, that's with an I on the end, Elementary Rising. And she'll be talking about the reading that she will be doing for the public the week after with D.T. Friedman, who was on the program a couple of months ago. And that's going to be Tuesday, February 4th at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art, free admission, doors open 6:30, blah, 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 blah. I'll talk about that more a great deal. Also, by the way, if you want, you can go to the Hour of the Wolf group on Facebook, or you can go to the NYRSF group, that's NYRSF, as in New York Review for Science Fiction, readings group, also on Facebook, and get more announcements there. So, thank you all for listening. This has been Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. If you would like to write me, you can certainly do so. Care of OurWolf.com, that would be Jim at HOURWOLF.com, or you can try Facebook. At any rate, thank you for listening. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, hopefully not snowed out and coming your way over these airwaves. Take care and have a wonderful morning.
You're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, WBAI.org.
Come on. each and every one of you for coming by.
And while he's thanking those folks, let me take this opportunity to thank all of you, our listeners and support staff, our contributors, our interns, the volunteers, producers, and the entire crew that works countless hours to bring WBAI into your lives.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff in studio with Peter Phillips. Joining us today are co-authors Mark Pilisook and Jennifer Roundtree to discuss their new book, The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War. We're also joined later in the program by Tara Drabji, journalist, author most recently with Susan Rahman of a chapter in forthcoming Project Censored book, Censored 2016, Existence is Resistance, Women in Occupied Palestine and Kashmir. Please stay with us. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Joining us today are co-authors Mark Pilisook and Jennifer Acord Roundtree. They are authors recently of a book called The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War. That book is available from Monthly Review Press. We're going to talk today about the all-pervasive occurrence of violence makes it seem like an unavoidable aspect of the human world. Our guests today demonstrate otherwise. Widespread violence, they argue, is in fact an expression of the underlying social order, and whether it is carried out by military forces or by patterns of investment, the aim is to strengthen that order for the benefit of the powerful. So today we're going to discuss these issues with Mark Pilisook and Jennifer Roundtree. Later in the program, we'll also be joined by Tara Drabji, who a name KPFA listeners may be familiar with. She's a host of Apex Express. She's also co-author with Susan Rahman of a chapter in the forthcoming Project Censored book, Censored 2016, called Existence is Resistance, Women of Occupied Palestine and Kashmir. So, Peter, please introduce our first guests today.
Mark Pilisook teaches at Saybrook University and is a professor emeritus of human and community development at the University of California, Davis. He's a former president of the Society for the Study of Peace, Conflict, and Violence, and a steering committee member of Psychologists for Social Responsibility. He's published 10 books and more than 140 articles over an academic career spanning five decades, of which 20 years ago, Mark was my professor at UC Davis. Joining us also is Jennifer Acord Roundtree, a research manager at the National Indian Child Welfare Association in Portland, Oregon. She has a PhD in psychology from Saybrook Graduate School and Research Center in San Francisco and supports American Indian, Alaska Native tribes and urban Indian communities in community-based participatory research. Mark and Jennifer, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The book is called The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and the War. And Mark, let's just start with you. What's your motivation to have written this book, and what do you see as the main message?
One motivation has to do with the morale of people who are engaged in large numbers of wonderful projects, projects that are assisting people who have been victimized, projects that are trying to save portions of the environment. And they find, after years of involvement, the prospects for the larger goals that they have seem not to be getting better and sometimes getting worse. And the question then is why and what can we do to prevent their burning out in their efforts? And one thought that we had was that it would help them to understand the nature of the system which most people say does not work, but in fact does work. It works excellently on behalf of a small number of people who are transnational, part of a transnational elite, linked in a network. It's not a conspiracy. It involves large numbers of people, but there are some who are identifiable, who are central to it. And if we understand their power and how they work to constrain the agenda, then we have some leverage on how best to change it.
So what I hear you saying, Mark, is that there's a power elite globally, kind of transnational corporations, that conflict serves their interests. And this is conflict, both wars, but also economic conflict that creates inequality and mass loss of life, actually, on a daily basis.
A much larger number of people die of poverty than from all kinds of direct violence. And much of that poverty is on the downside of an economic process which has deprived people of a way to live with a viable economy in their own areas where they've lived, where their families have lived, where their traditions have been for years. Those people are chronically displaced by the exploitation of their resources, and when they resist, the elite is in position to impose military constraints, to buy governments, and to prevent them from getting justice, in which case some of them become violent, and then we use their violence as an excuse to terrorize the whole population.
Jennifer Acre Roundtree, let's bring you into the conversation. And you are a co-author of The Hidden Structure of Violence, Who Benefits from Global Violence and War, with Professor Mark Pilosuk. In the beginning, in the introduction of the book, you have a segment on lessons from the past. And as an historian, that certainly is something that I appreciate significant in terms of context. Could you talk a little bit about the context for the study and the scope of the book? The scope of the book, by the way, of course, for listeners, is vast, and we certainly hope people pick it up. So can you talk a little bit about this, the context?
I can, and I wanted to add that in my work in working with American Indian and Alaska Native populations, I've become more familiar and educated around the idea of historical trauma. And we work under a Native researcher. Her name is Dr. Maria Yellowhorse Braveheart, who really identified this phenomenon, and she defines historical trauma as the cumulative emotional and psychological wounding over the lifespan and across generations. So in this case, we're talking about communities that have been killed in great numbers, which qualifies as genocide, of course, vast numbers of children that have been removed from their families and placed with white families. Nowadays, they suffer from inadequate health care. Disproportionate number of them struggle with poverty and alcoholism. But I think really the point of talking about this is that what sets communities like the American Indian community and also the Jewish Holocaust survivor community, who've also, the literature talks about historical trauma in their community, is that these are, specific racial and ethnic communities that have been persecuted repeatedly over generations. So in the case of American Indians, over 500 years worth of U.S. policy. So official U.S. policy, removal, assimilation, extermination, which the purpose was really to wipe them off the map. And so, in thinking back, as they say, 2020 vision looking back, we see that this was simply because we wanted their land and we wanted their resources. So the point of bringing this into the introduction is to just bear in mind that U.S. policy is not always just and right and justified in its violent actions, and to really question when we hear that we are called to save another country from their leadership, for example, or to give them freedom, that we really need to question what other motives may be behind our aggressive actions.
Certainly, Jennifer, in the book, they talk about people, farmland, control of water, and, of course, economic resources, natural resources worldwide, and say that not only is the U.S., well, the U.S. is certainly one of the leading countries that perpetuates violence in the world. There's many others. But Western Europeans have had a mental agenda that it's okay to literally conquer the world and acquire it. That's still with us today in that respect. Could you comment on that?
That's right. And again, just to say that what really makes the book unique is its scope. So we really begin by talking about psychological theory and the human capacity for violence, and then we define violence very broadly. So to include structural violence, which really has put a heavy burden on particularly land-based communities that depend on growing their own food and selling their own food. And so we talk a lot about the structural violence around food production and the globalization of food and biotechnologies and so on and so forth, and how the system really works against those land-based communities. And I know I spent some time in Central America when I was studying with Mark. So I really got to see firsthand some of these. We talk about physical violence, direct violence. It's so easy to see the cause and effects, but the causes and effects of structural violence, there's more distance between the policy and the effect it has on the family. But in living in these communities, you really begin to see their state structures that support local farmers are dissolved as a result of transnational agreements, for example. The seed saving projects that they once were able to share with farmers in their communities, they're not allowed to do that anymore under, you know, certain GMO restrictions and other structural policies. So does that answer the question? I'm sorry.
Well certainly. And the magnitude, of course, in the book you cite, 870 million people are chronically malnourished. Many of them dying on a daily basis. And that's violence, and that's literally an attack on human beings and the nature of human beings. Now, Mark, right up front, the cost of modern war in Chapter 1 is quite extensive. Bill Domhoff describes your book as encyclopedic and highly focused analysis of the hidden structures of violence. And you just start right out, 250 wars since World War II. The U.S. has had 390 military interventions since World War II. Of course, we have 900 bases worldwide, 130 nations. How is this maintained? I mean, how can we possibly be doing this?
One way that it gets maintained is that it becomes normalized and not a matter of news. So that if you think about how these decisions get made and by whom, you track it down to the most influential players. And there are a group of these, and they can be studied now. We have ways of tracking the networks that connect these individuals. We have ways in which we can track the ways that these individuals have control over media outlets to frame what is news. And the Department of Defense budget is not news. There was a tremendous increase right at this time in drone warfare, which is not news. There's a rise in the budget for the development of new nuclear weapons at the Lawrence Livermore and laboratories. That is not news. And the lobbying activities of those who have a stake in that warfare economy is also not news. So that many of the people in Congress who have to approve that budget are there because of their contributions of the defense industries to their campaigns, and their selection as candidates has been predicated on the power of those individuals also.
Your Chapter 5, Networks of Power, is certainly an area that I'm familiar with and love to research. And you talk about the major corporations that benefit from war, Bechtel, Carlyle, Halliburton, and GE and many others, but also how their networks of people that are in support of these corporations are manifested through the Trilateral Commission, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Business Roundtable, Defense Policy Board, the IMF, the World Bank, all of which support a very concentrated wealth accumulation among corporate elite who have a shared consciousness because they have these institutions where they meet and hang out. Would you comment on that a bit more, Mark?
I'm not trying to demonize that elite. I'm saying that these are people who have t- typically gone to an Ivy League school, have been raised in a community where everybody has the same beliefs that they have. They are definitely believers in the fact that their success and the success of their families makes them icons and sources of wisdom for how the world should work, and that they feel that they have the competence, the knowledge, and also happen to have the power to make it that way. I think that one of the things that an analysis of the network gives you is the places where, in order to gain a foothold in that network, you have a number of rituals that one goes through. Those rituals screen out all of the dissenting voices that say that there should not be a central group. And in fact, the central group is inherently anti-democratic. That it inherently means that those who have power have the right to constrain. Those who have power and wealth have the right to constrain what an election looks like, who gets elected.